welcome to another Friday edition of the Dynamic Duo Show, right here at GCNLive.com. I'm Kevin Barrett. I'm on here every Friday and Monday. My good friend and occasional intellectual sparring partner, the ever troublesome Jim Fetzer, comes on Tuesdays, Wednesdays, and Thursdays. And I should mention also that I'm on the weekend now in a new show on We the People Radio Network from 2 to 4 p.m. every Saturday and Sunday. That is Central Time. Well, my guest today is a very special guest indeed. He's one of a rare handful of great people that I am proud to take some credit for bringing on board into the 9/11 truth movement. His name is Professor Anthony J. Hall. And he's the founding coordinator and professor of globalization studies at the University of Lethbridge. His book, The American Empire and the Fourth World, won the Alberta Book Award for the best nonfiction work by an Albertan author in 2004. And he will be speaking with me at an event in Edmonton, Alberta, which you can find out about by going to Edmonton911truth.com. This will be happening in early September. It's coming up real fast. It's actually Saturday, September 6th, to be precise. Now, Tony Hall is a guy, I got to know him through Splitting the Sky, a very hardcore truth-telling Native American activist that will be on my show tomorrow on We the People from 3 to 4 p.m. This was last spring. And since then, Tony Hall has been looking at 9/11, and he's going to be doing a talk with me there in Edmonton. So, hey, it's great to have you. Tony Hall, how's it going?
Oh, real well. Good to hear from you, Kevin.
Yeah, well, boy, you know, I continue to be amazed at the truth-telling globalization studies professors that you guys have up there north of the border. You know, I don't know quite how this works, but, you know, for some reason, we don't have so much in the way of critical globalization studies, at least at the University of Wisconsin. And there's, you know, you and Michelle Chustodowski and a whole contingent of people in Canada that are making really important strides in understanding what's actually going on in the world with this so-called process of globalization. How did you take up that topic and what kind of insights into what's really happening with globalization did the study of that topic bring you?
Well, I pitched the concept of globalization studies in 2003 to the administration of my university, the University of Lethbridge. I've been working since 1982 in Native studies or Native American studies, and that's how I came to work with Splitting the Sky on a lot of issues. He's a very important figure in the Attica situation, the biggest prison crisis in the history of the United States in 1971. He was charged with killing a cop. He was front and center in an Indian war that took place in Canada in 1995. The Canadian Army was there. They were using landmines. It was at Gustafson Lake, and he was the Sundance captain at the time. And interestingly, a U.S. court, eventually we got to present this all in front of a U.S. court, Judge Janice Stewart in Portland, Oregon. And one of the things that Judge Stewart decided in agreeing with our point that a veteran of the Battle of Gustafson Lake should not be extradited to Canada because he had been criminalized for political reasons. One of the things that judge agreed was that disinformation and smear, the Canadian government had done a disinformation and smear campaign, and I'm quoting from an RCMP officer. I think this reality that governments, police forces have studied this as almost as an art or a science, disinformation and smear, and that's their terms, not mine. That's something that Splitting the Sky was subject to. And so working in Native American studies, this was the kind of thing that I was looking at. Things are not necessarily as rosy and cozy for dissident professors as it might seem to you. We do take our knocks, and we do have our own thought police, and you know, it's a very it's kind of the police have a very powerful role, the RCMP in Canada. In any case, after I got involved in Splitting the Sky, there was a, not surprisingly, some disagreement with my colleagues in Native Studies. Anyway, by this time I had been looking at Native people, not in, only in North America or in the Western Hemisphere, but looking at indigenous peoples globally, realizing that imperialism or colonization, the building of empires by France and Britain and Portugal, even Belgium was in Africa, that in a way this was driving force of globalization for much of the last 500 years, especially since 1492, when supposedly America was quote-unquote discovered. Christopher Columbus thought he was in India and called the people he met Indians, and that mistake has been in the language ever since. So I began to think that this is a bigger process. So I pitched this idea of globalization studies. Chau Sadowski, who you mentioned, I became quite intrigued with his work, especially in the bombing of NATO, of Yugoslavia, back in, was it 91? It was 99. And, you know, he had a very deep analysis of what was really going on. So in a sense, the war on terror, this idea that you can go and break all the international laws and just bomb people and say you're doing it for truth and democracy and the American way and human rights and just keep bombing and committing violence in the name of democracy and human rights. I mean, this didn't start after 2001, obviously. So anyway, I've been working in globalization studies. I'm a unit of one. I've faced interrogation from the RCMP in my office at the University of Lethbridge.
Really? Did they just barge in there, or did they call first?
Oh, no, they didn't call. It was just before the Free Trade Area of the Americas event in 2001. I'd organized a conference. Of course, the Free Trade Area of the Americas, they were getting together all 34 countries, the heads of state, with an effort to create a new commercial unit, a new economic unit, a free trade area that would extend NAFTA. And what do all these 34 countries, except Cuba wasn't invited, have in common? They're all on the lands of people we now call Indians, indigenous peoples. Were they invited to the process? Were they part of the process? No. Were they part of the process in, say, 1493, when the Pope donated the Western Hemisphere to the Spanish crown? Were they part of the process when Thomas Jefferson signed over or received what was then called Louisiana from Napoleon? No. I mean, we keep adjusting. Were they even asked their opinion when Alaska was transferred from Russia to the United States in 1867? And on and on. Were they asked when the Hudson's Bay Company transferred a big part of what's now Western Canada? No. So that was the point I was making, and I was subject to controversial actions by police and government. So it's not completely as secure and safe as it might seem here in Canada, but I think it's safer than in your country.
Yeah, well, we get in trouble for asking tough questions here, too. I'll be back in a moment. This is Kevin Barrett talking with Anthony Hall. Stick around.
This is Cascadia Public Radio.
Blackbird singing in the dead of night. Take these broken wings and learn to fly all your life. You are only waiting for this moment to arise.
Welcome back to Blackbird, the Dynamic Duo Show. I'm Kevin Barrett, and today I'm talking with Professor Anthony Hall. He's the founding coordinator and professor of globalization studies at the University of Lethbridge, where the Mounties pay him a visit when he gets a little too controversial for their taste. He's also a consultant and advisor to the Canadian Museum of Human Rights, and the author of many essays and journal articles on Native American studies. He came to globalization studies through Native American studies. We just talked a little bit about that. And Tony, you know, I think Native American studies is a great prism for globalization studies because, well, as Alfred Crosby puts it in his book, Ecological Imperialism, The Biological Expansion of Europe, 900 to 1900, that if some intelligent life form out there in space, and, you know, let's hope there's some out there because there aren't so many down here, were taking a hard look at what had been going on this planet over the past 1,000 years, what they would notice, first and foremost, would be this biological expansion of Europe, where European human beings and European flora and fauna took over the temperate zones of the entire planet, virtually the entire planet. And that extermination of the native peoples and much of the native flora and fauna throughout the temperate zones was the biggest change on Earth, and it set up this world that we're now in, which is a European-dominated world. Of course, Europe colonized the world in the 19th and 20th centuries, took over the whole world, and we're living with some of the blowback from that right now. And so from the perspective of a Native American, of course, you know, that's the perspective of somebody who was living here in this, you know, this particular temperate zone when it was exterminated, or, you know, when this European sort of genocidal move in happened. And that's a really important kind of perspective, I think, because, you know, history is usually written by the victors. And it's important to get the other perspective out there.
Well, you think of that process that you're describing. I mean, it's just accelerated since 1492. Think of how much habitat of species is being destroyed as forestry is taking place, as agricultural lands are expanded into forests. You know, there's a diminution of species at a rate of one about every 10 minutes. E.O. Wilson writes about this. This is a huge crisis, you know, that we associate this with Amazonia, with what goes on in, say, places like the Congo. But if you think about the human side of diversity, there was about 12,000 languages spoken when Christopher Columbus arrived in what was subsequently called the Americas. There's not one prototypical Indian. Indigenous peoples in the Western Hemisphere were extremely diverse, you know, from the people in what is now southwestern United States, in Pueblos, to Cherokee people. Cherokee people had plantations. They had black slaves, even. Iroquoian peoples, the buffalo hunters, a tremendous amount of diversity in the way human beings arrange their political economies. If you think about languages now, instead of this number of languages being spoken, it's diminished now. You know, most of these languages, the vast majority of these languages are endangered. I said 12,000 languages spoken in the world. I misspoke. 12,000 languages spoken in the world. We're down to about 6,000 languages, but many of those languages have 5 speakers, 10 speakers. So on some level, we're losing our diversity in many ways. Yes, the plants and animals are losing the diversity, but we as human beings are being pressed into narrower and narrower sort of enclaves of conformity. And the type of conformity we're getting now in what I'm calling an era of a terror economy, it's getting pretty grave. These environmental issues, for instance, you know, I think there is a very big part of the agenda to try to push these issues to the side and play on our fears and use our fears to drive economic forces, to secure power for entrenched elites and oligarchs everywhere, to encourage suspicion between peoples. My goodness, the threat of global peace and world harmony would really affect elites who run and control everything. And
well, that's right. They need to divide and conquer people to keep them under control. And hey, we already have a caller, Tony, which is kind of a good sign to have a caller that quickly. It's Julia from South Dakota. Oh, okay. Well, it looks like Julia might have dropped off. Hopefully we'll get her back in a little bit. But I think you're right, Tony.
Get into the Edmonton event and all those kind of issues. South Dakota kind of rings a bell of what I've had in mind.
Okay.
I don't want to you lead the agenda or not.
We can talk about our event coming up in Edmonton, which people can see on the web at Edmonton911truth.com. We have a series of events, but I guess the key one is that the talk on Saturday, September 6th. And I know I'll be talking about the importance of understanding false flag terror and war trigger events
from
a historical perspective, because it's not just empirical. Empirically, we know that most of the U.S. wars since the Mexican War, perhaps all of them, appear to have been set off by orchestrated events, whether false flag attacks
or
non-attacks.
Events, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I imagine, obviously you're speaking on this issue all the time and with great import and great effect, I believe. I'm new to the 9/11 truth movement, and I worked a bit with Splitting the Sky, and he was so overtaken with the importance of it. We went on the net and started looking at things, and I've been following it and certainly fascinated in the war on terror, the so-called war on terror. But he forced me to look at it more closely, and I went on your show. So it's by virtue of my one appearance on your show that I was invited to be part of this event in Edmonton.
I guess they liked your performance.
it's really great talking with a colleague from the university who can talk about these issues in an accessible, sort of straightforward way. Maybe not everybody listening in, the vast audience that no doubt is out there, is really clear about where Edmonton is. Edmonton is the capital city of Alberta. Alberta is one of 10 Canadian provinces. Alberta is the province on the eastern slopes of the Rockies, just to the east of British Columbia.
It's sort of the Canadian Colorado.
Of a huge amount of oil and gas development, and maybe we'll pick that up. I can hear the little hint from the music that we've got many more of these wonderful sponsors. Kevin Barrett, expansive commentary on history over 500 years.
The commercial sponsors are lining up for my show.
Okay.
We'll be back in a moment. Kevin Barrett and Tony Hall.
Thank you for listening to GCN. Be sure to visit GCNLive.com today.
Welcome back to the Dynamic Duo Show. I'm Kevin Barrett, and hey, happiness is a warm gun. I guess John Lennon said, well, that means you've just killed something. And that brings us to the topic we're talking about today. This is Kevin Barrett talking with Anthony Hall. He's a professor of globalization studies at the University of Lethbridge. We're talking about our joint appearance at an upcoming 9/11 truth event in Edmonton, Alberta, on the eastern slope of the Rockies. That'll be on September 9th, and people can find out about it at Edmonton911truth.com. And speaking of happiness is a warm gun, that means you've just killed something. Well, I think that there's a real connection, I guess, between the Native American studies and the topic of 9/11 and other false flag attacks in that the purpose of false flag attacks is to demonize the alleged attackers and thereby launch a war, usually a war of aggression, against that people. And that war, which is really a euphemism for mass murder, is usually driven by some form of demonization of the target, because you know it's very opposed to innate human nature to kill people, especially aggressively, so that the people that are going to be killed in mass have to be demonized, as Native Americans were demonized as being somehow subhuman, non-Christian, and other, which allowed that genocide to happen. And likewise, with false flag attacks, the whole purpose is to cast the other side as the aggressor and thereby demonize them. And we certainly saw that in spades with the way Arabs and Muslims were demonized by the 9/11 / anthrax attacks.
Well, it's interesting that when you come to Canada, you're coming into a political culture that exists because not everybody went along with the American Revolution. When some people in Anglo-America said King George is some kind of tyrant, in fact, not everybody agreed, and the people who had a lot to do with establishing my country, Canada, fought the Anglo-American rebels, and a lot of those people who fought the Anglo-American rebels were Indians. And in fact, in the War of 1812, the Indian Confederacy in the Great Lakes area was allied with the British Empire against the Anglo-Americans. So there is a history of Indian fighting and genocide in the United States, but it is a little bit different in Canada. Not to say that at the last 100 years, they've kind of gone along. Obviously, reserves and reservations are usually pretty marginalized and depressed. But there was a period where this Indian question was central in the geopolitics of the Civil War in the British Empire. And one side of that Civil War was those who said, let's push westward. Let's not make treaties with the indigenous peoples. Let's push them aside, exterminate them if necessary. That's our God-given right. That's our manifest destiny. Thomas Jefferson, in writing the Declaration of Independence, in drafting it and in explaining to the world why this revolution was taking place, why this secessionist movement, this civil war, was being pressed against King George III, he laid out, Thomas Jefferson did, in the Declaration of Independence, and go right to the Declaration of Independence if you don't believe me, he laid out the crimes of King George III, and the final allegation made against the king was that he did bring on the merciless Indian savages, whose known means of warfare is undistinguished destruction of all ages, sexes, and conditions. And that's a precise quote off the top of my head from your Declaration of Independence,
right,
referring to the merciless Indian savages, who are essentially terrorists, who are essentially racially profiled in such a way that they're right off the bat from day one in U.S., in the formation of the United States. Canada is older than the United States. This rebel movement that founded the United States was founded with the idea that the people living on the lands that was about to be taken over were merciless Indian savages. So I would say that the war on terror, in a sense, didn't start in 2001. It's right in the Declaration of Independence. And this idea that there is savages, there is terrorists, there is some group of people out there that can't be extended law, that can't be subject to the rule of law or due process. They're so destructive, they're so anarchistic, they're so unpredictable that they have to be treated kind of like animals and exterminated and put into camps and places like, there were concentration camps in the Western expansion of the United States. Is Guantanamo Bay a concentration camp? Are these dark sites that the United States is keeping, putting indigenous peoples all over the world because they might get in the way of grab for resources? Is this an extension of what we saw at the founding of the United States in the Declaration of Independence? So when you go to Alberta, when you come into our country, into Canada, you will be coming into the province, which is in a way the most buddy-buddy with the Bush White House. Harper comes from Alberta. He's the current Prime Minister of Canada. And the biggest import, the biggest exporter of oil right now to the United States comes directly from the province of Alberta. It has exceeded Saudi Arabia. The most energy, oil energy, that the United States is getting from any country comes from the Alberta, comes from the Alberta tar sands, which is a few hundred miles north of Edmonton. Edmonton is away, the capital city of it. The local, regional capital is called Fort McMurray. And this is a huge geopolitical shift. This is something that has happened very recently.
I didn't know that, Tony. There's more tar sands oil coming out of Alberta into the U.S. than the U.S. is getting from Saudi Arabia?
Yes. Oil and Gas Journal. You know, the oil and gas industry has changed a lot, and it's hard to think of ExxonMobil and Shell and BP and Chevron, but you know, they're losing ground because people are so disgusted, especially after the invasion of Iraq, that, you know, countries like Venezuela, countries like, Brazil, countries like Malaysia, they are getting national oil companies. Iran has a big national oil company. And these national oil companies are going to dominate about 80% of the world's reserves. So this is, you know, this Bush administration, which was, you know, trying to represent oil and gas interests, is really undermining the interests of the United States on this crucial level. But the one place that the U.S. has the U.S. or global oil companies, the capitalist companies, free market companies, have a sort of wide open field is in the Alberta tar sands, and that's calculated to be 50 to 70% of those future areas accessible to these big companies. So Alberta is really, really an important place right now. It's a province that doesn't really have a very well developed political culture. It's been the same government there, provincial government, for decades, and it's part of the Midwest type of environment. But there are progressive people in Edmonton, and you're going to be meeting them, and I'm looking forward to meeting a lot of the new ones too.
Well, I'm looking forward to it. Looking forward to shaking the place up a little bit on September 9th. People can find out about that at Edmonton911truth.com. We'll be back in a bit, so stay tuned.
Hey Jude, don't make it bad. Take a sad song and make it better. Remember to let it start to make it better. Hey, Jude.
Welcome back. This is the Dynamic Duo Show. You're listening to GCNLive.com. I'm Kevin Barrett. I'm talking with Anthony Hall. He's a globalization studies professor with whom I will be doing a speaking engagement on September 9th in Edmonton, Alberta. And as I've said before, you can find out about that at Edmonton911truth.com. And Tony, just before the break, we were talking about the way the Bush administration has screwed up U.S. Oil supply possibilities with its outrageous and illegal invasion and occupation of Iraq. And now it looks like the U.S. is losing some of its access or planned access to Caspian Basin energy supplies, as the Russians are cutting deals with Kazakhstan. The Russians are exerting themselves in Georgia. This U.S. puppet regime there is reeling from this crazed attack on the Russians in South Ossetia. It doesn't look too good for the U.S. energy strategy. But, you know, they're still in Iraq. And I think that's, Tony, I think the purpose of that Iraq war was to have future control of Iraq's oil wealth. You know, there's a new book out last year, I guess, that said that the actual total of Iraq's oil reserves, and this is sweet crude, the highest quality oil It was not 100 billion barrels, as they had always said, but actually possibly more than 300 billion barrels, which would put it well ahead of Saudi Arabia in terms of reserves. That's more than $30 trillion worth of oil at today's prices. And I think the U.S. geostrategists are going to try to hang on to that by hook or by crook.
Well, let's not forget that it was Iraq where OPEC, the export oil exporting countries, was founded in 1960. The government of Iraq has been very ahead of the game historically in asserting, well, I would say the control of indigenous peoples over their own natural resources. Of course, British Petroleum developed that resource, and it was treated as if it was a British resource, and the indigenous peoples there had no right to it. So in the late 50s, a leader there by the name of Qassem started to assert local control over oil, and this was part of a global process, and they established a national oil company, which Saudi Arabia subsequently copied. Qassem, interestingly, was assassinated with U.S. backing, as so many other leaders of indigenous peoples who tried to move out of the colonized status and assert some kind of control over their own countries and over their own natural resources as a part of their way to decide their own future. This was not in conformity to the U.S. policies in the Cold War. So Qassem was taken out. Saddam Hussein was backed up by the CIA, as bin Laden was backed up by the CIA, as Noriega was backed up by the CIA. And so the history of Iraq, it's been very assertive historically of over control over its resources. And, of course, Saddam Hussein was requesting and asserting that he wanted oil bought in euros or in yen, not in American dollars. In 1973, after the in 1974-75, after the Arab oil embargo, when prices quadrupled, and people will remember how traumatic that was, you know, people lining up and at gas stations, not enough gas. There was a successful embargo, but there was a deal made. The deal was that oil should be purchased from the OPEC countries in American dollars. So oil about quadrupled in price, but the American dollar, which had just left the gold standard, Nixon made this deal, and so the American dollars sort of resecured its position in the world as the main currency of exchange. But since the invasion of Iraq, countries like China, certainly Saudi Arabia, they are angry. They resent this, and the the dollar has been falling in value. So
don't forget Iran, Tony. Iran actually has gone off the dollar apparently, and that has a lot to do with the tension with the U.S. You know, I think we have
and Venezuela. So the dilemma faced by the United States right now, you know, the global fallout from this terrible decision of the Bush White House to go into Iraq the way it did against the wishes of the Security Council, against global and international public opinion. Did you demonstrate on February the 15th, 2003, like 40 million people around the world who said, don't do it, don't invade Iraq in this way, but White House went ahead and did it. The United States has faced, a lot of people are displeased with it and angry with it, but the United States has never been this unpopular, this subject to infamy, to outrage of people around the world, there are consequences to it. Part of the value, the issue of the falling dollar, people, these reserves, these especially in the Muslim world, these countries that kept their reserves in American dollars are unloading their American dollars. The amount of personal debt in the United States, I'm changing the subject here, but this is a key idea that I want to get out. In 1979, personal debt, private debt that we have on our credit cards, on our mortgages, companies have, it was 20% of the gross national product. Today, the private debt that we carry is 500 times 500%, five times greater than the gross national product, five times greater.
Wow. That's just unsustainable. Listen, I think we have a caller, and I'd like to check before the break, because we're just about to have our break for the news. Do we have a caller?
Yeah, I'm here.
Hey, hi, who is this?
This is Mike from Kentucky.
Hey, Mike, hi, how's it going?
Pretty well, I'm just sealing a deck, and I thought I'd take a break and call you.
Okay, so what's on your mind? We're talking about the sad state of affairs. The U.S. has squandered its empire on this crazed Iraq invasion. I mean, maybe at the end of the U.S. empire is not such a bad thing. What's your take, Mike?
It's all connected. The dollar, the oil, the empire. I'm with you guys 100% on the indigenous people and all that. Regarding what you were just talking about, the global outrage, I think it's really time for sanctions like you would against any rogue state that violates international law and so on. Hopefully, the world will get that together. But my question was really about the oil sands. I understand that it is a very extensive resource. There's a lot of it. And I was aware that the shift has happened and we're actually getting more from Canada now than from Saudi Arabia. But I hear different things about the rate of extraction and refinement.
It's tar sands, so it has to be processed, and it takes about 7 barrels of water to get a barrel of oil, and it's very energy intensive. So in fact, it's creating a huge amount of this toxins that create global warming.
Right.
The tar sands create more CO2 emissions than all the transportation system of Canada put together. So it's a very dirty technology. And because of the politics in Alberta, there's not much regulation. And it's Cheney has come up. Bill Gates was up there. Warren Buffett was up there just a few days ago. I think it's going to be regulated, environmentally regulated from the United States, that environmentalists in the United States aren't going to let this happen, which is kind of humiliating to my province and to my country that we can't, that we're just so gung-ho to get the Yankee buck, that we're not, regulating and doing this in an intelligent, measured way. Kevin will be able to.
I've heard it's not very energy efficient. That you have to burn a lot of natural gas to get every barrel of tar sand oil.
Yeah, that's right. And of course, in burning that, you create pollution. You create CO2 emission.
And you also burn up all that gas that could have been used for energy itself.
Yeah, and they're talking about putting nuclear plants in and all of that kind of thing. It's a huge issue.
All right. Well, hey, we're heading into the break. We'll be back for another hour of conversation.
Nice to hear you from Kentucky.
Yeah.
I can hang on if you want.
Yeah, you can hang on over the break, Mike.
Okay.
Okay, it's Kevin Barrett with Professor Anthony J. Hall and Mike from Kentucky. We'll be back after the news, so stick around here at GCN Live. Back to the second hour of today's edition of the Dynamic Duo Show. I'm Kevin Barrett, and my guest today is Professor Anthony J. Hall. He is the author of The American Empire in the Fourth World, as well as some other books, including Celebrating Together, Native People in Ontario's Bicentennial, and he's a contributing author to Through Indian Eyes, The Untold Story of Native Peoples. And we still have Mike from Kentucky on the line. We are talking about the resource grab, the global resource grab that's been going on for quite some time and seems to be getting ever more intense right now, especially in the area of energy and especially oil. And Mike was just asking about tar sands, this huge new product of Alberta that is apparently both a very dirty and a not terribly energy efficient technology, requires burning a lot of natural gas to get a unit of energy out of the tar sands. And Tony, when did that surpass Saudi Arabia as the U.S.'s first source of oil.
This whole phenomena is perhaps 4 or 5 years old. I'm not sure the exact day that it surpassed it. I read it in Kevin Phillips' book, Bad Money, just a few days ago. But, of course, the rapid rising of the cost of oil, the price of oil, suddenly made this quote-unquote economic to do these technologies, to access this oil. All my life I've heard about this tar sands, and, you know, it's hundreds of square miles and with the sand just packed with it. There's other issues. For instance, it's right in the northern the Arctic water flow, and Chippewyan Indians downstream are getting extremely high rates of cancer. So there's all kind of, there's the issue of toxic pollution into the air. It's really terrible on the water ecology of northern Canada. But there it is.
Well, it could be that we're going to see more and more of this kind of dirty and uneconomic resource grabbing as the good oil starts to run out.
Should we move a little towards 9/11 there?
Oh, yeah, sure. Let's move back to 9/11. That's, of course, what we'll be talking about in Edmonton on September 9th. You said some brave things about 9/11 last time you were on my show that got you listed in the Hall of Fame, PatriotsQuestion911.com. You compared the 9/11 question to Copernicus and Galileo, saying that the sun is the center of the universe and getting persecuted for it. But so what? Did you want to talk
about?
Yeah,
of course. Just the way you put it there, that people are persecuted. They understand truth in a certain way. They try to evaluate it. Copernicus and Galileo both said, no, it's not the Earth that is the center of the universe. The sun, the planets go around the sun. And the Earth is a planet of the sun. And those two individuals were subjected to the Inquisition. The Roman Catholic Church said, no, this is heresy. I get a feeling of that with some of these issues in 9/11. I mean, the buildings just couldn't have fallen the way they did at the speed of gravity, with them, supposedly the metal melting and then the weight of gravity as one floor after the next piles on top of each other.
How metal clearly don't in the first place. I mean, the hydrocarbon fires can't get anywhere near the point of melting steel. They can't get within a 1,000 degrees of it, even in the controlled burn. So, I mean, they can't get within 2,000 degrees of it in a real life situation.
Yeah, so the comparison that I was making was that just as in an earlier era, the establishment of that time, the Roman Catholic Church said, this is the truth that you must absorb. And some said, no, my reason doesn't lead me to that conclusion. I don't, I've studied this. I've looked at it. The fall of World Trade Center 7 is just obviously an internal demolition.
Can you believe this latest NIST report, Tony? This really is just
it's such a disgrace. It's such an embarrassment. It must be so embarrassing that important national institutions like this standard-setting institution are so humiliating themselves. But Kevin, I'd like to try to sort of continue in the Alberta. I haven't started actually typing it out yet, but I am going to present a paper, and it's going to be my, in a sense, debutante. I haven't really gone into writing. I'm speaking now. I've spoken on this program about 9/11, but let me try to set this, in a Canadian context, because obviously in Edmonton, which is the capital of Alberta, an important Canadian city. We're going to be wanting to look at the Canadian context. And the reality is that shortly after 9/11, the Canadian Armed Forces went into Afghanistan along with NATO. And 93 Canadian soldiers have been killed. We've had aid workers killed in Kabul. this war on the Taliban. It's really it's a Pushtun part of the Afghanistan, the Pushtun tribe, the ethnic group, you know, tend to support the Taliban. So we've got issues about 9/11. It did occur to me to start with an analysis that reminds us of Leonard Pelcher, who was picked up in 1975 in Hinton, Alberta. Leonard Pelcher was part of the American Indian movement. There was a return to Wounded Knee in 1973, a very high profile, probably in the 20th century in the United States. The main focus in that 100-year period on Aboriginal people took place as a result of AIMS activism in South Dakota, and that's the caller that briefly came in, but then she didn't stay on the line from South Dakota. This is where the Pine Ridge Reserve is. This is where Wounded Knee is. And there was a kind of civil war on Pine Ridge with dozens of AIMS supporters being killed by paramilitary forces, backed by the FBI and Dick Wilson. Leonard Pelche was charged with killing two FBI officers in the midst of this. He came to Canada. He was picked up in Hinton, Alberta, at Small Boys Camp. He was taken over to Vancouver, and he was extradited. And this is a very celebrated case. Many of your listeners will have heard of Leonard Pelche. In some parts of the world, Leonard Pelche is seen as a major political prisoner in the United States today. When Reagan and his counterpart in the Soviet Union first talked, the name Pelche came up very quickly because they taught about Pelche in the Soviet Union as part of the Cold War psychological warfare. So Pelche was picked up in Alberta, taken to Vancouver, and from there he was extradited. And the U.S. Justice Department presented false evidence, Myrtle Perbar's testimony, false evidence to our government. To our government, we were told lies. Pelche was extradited, and I want to remind the audience on September the 6th in Edmonton that we have a history of the United States official bodies lying to us about very serious matters.
Do we ever, just like NIST did the other day. We'll be right back.
That it's evolution. Well, you know, we all want to change the world. But when you talk about destruction, don't you know that you can count me out? Don't you know it's gonna be alright? Alright.
Welcome back. It's the Dynamic Duo Show. I'm Kevin Durrett. I'm talking with Professor Anthony J. Hall today. He's the professor of globalization studies at the University of Lethbridge. And as you were saying, Tony, the FBI lied when it got Leonard Peltier extradited from Canada. And, of course, that's not the only time the FBI has lied. There is this pattern of lies coming from American, U.S. American official bodies. Most recently, just the other day, NIST, the National Institute for Standards and Technology, put out this ludicrous report on Building 7, blaming the complete free fall speed vertical collapse of that building on ordinary office fires, which would be the first time in history that fire has made any tall building collapse. And what's really interesting about these lies is that they're coming from some very suspicious people. NIST is riddled with scientists whose expertise is in highly advanced nanothermites and similar high-tech explosive, incendiary metal-cutting materials. As Kevin Ryan has pointed out, especially after 9/11, Bush appointed these people to run NIST, and so the very suspects in the controlled demolition of the World Trade Center apparently ran that investigation. It's not surprising that they found no evidence of explosives.
Yeah, I glanced at the report of the report, and apparently they're saying because the plumbing wasn't working, the sprinkler system wasn't
right.
Anyway, it's mind-boggling. But let me try to pick up the thread. And, you know, this might may not altogether familiar with your audience, these points. But, you know, Canada is involved in the war on terror, the so-called war on terror. We have our soldiers in a very hot part of Afghanistan. And if our soldiers are there, our army is there based on lies that officials told our government, you know, obviously that is intolerable. And that's going to be, you know, there's a powerful argument to be made, and you and I are making it, that 9/11 is riddled with lie after lie. The official version is riddled with lie after lie after lie. It doesn't seem to me that it's required that we come up with a fully airtight, you know, theory of who did it. We don't believe the official version. The official version is preposterous. And my government has committed troops, and people are being killed in Canadian troops are being killed in Afghanistan because we're involved in a war on terror, going back to something called, you know, the events at 9/11. But let me just a very emotional issue for us here in Canada is the fact that Omar Khadr is he was 15 years old in Afghanistan, and his family was involved with Osama bin Laden. But anyway, he was picked up and taken to Guantanamo. General Romeo Dallaire has been very outspoken. He was head of the UN forces in Rwanda. And he's kind of a heroic figure in Canada. And he points out that Khadr was a child soldier. And there are, you know, there's all kinds of terrible things done in Africa, for instance, where militias pick up children and transform them into killers in armies. But these are children. And so Khadr, you know, is definitely not of age when he's involved in this. The Australians got their people out. The British got their people out of the, you know, horrific law-breaking situation in Guantanamo against Geneva Conventions and all the things that are going on there. So why is our Canadian citizen in there? Why isn't our own government of Stephen Harper doing anything about this? Now, Leonard Peltier case was very close to the matter that splitting it, this guy and I were working on when Pitawanakwit was in the United States and Canada was trying to extradite him in much the same way that U.S. Extradited Peltier. But unlike the Canadian government, who just accepted the lies and allowed the extradition to go forward and sent Peltier back to the States, the United States actually agreed with our argument in the case of Pitawanakwit versus the USA. And Pitawanakwit, O.J., James Pitawanakwit, is living in Oregon now, protected by the United States from U.S. government, from the Canadian government, who was involved, according to the courts of Oregon, in a kind of civil war situation at Gustafson Lake. So this brings my attention to John Graham, who just recently was extradited from Vancouver to Rapid City, South Dakota. And to me, this is a terrible violation of Canadian sovereignty. To send John Graham to the kangaroo courts of South Dakota, where, you know, Leonard Peltier was convicted in a process that is infamous, that is, you know, people around the world know of this and look to the United States and say, well, we don't have political prisoners. Of course you do. Leonard Peltier is a political prisoner in the United States. Now John Graham is there. John Graham, and so I'm going to try to relate this all to, you know, the Canadian take on 9/11, or my take on 9/11 in a Canadian context. John Graham is charged with killing Anime Aquash. Anime Aquash was a leading figure in the American Indian movement. And she was very close with Dennis Banks, Russell Means, the leadership of the American Indian movement, who went to Wounded Knee, the site of a major massacre by the U.S. Army on Native people in 1890. And they went back in 1973 as part of the symbolic sort of regaining their pride and their assertiveness and made a stand at Wounded Knee, and the U.S. Army got involved and the FBI got involved. And this was all part of the politics of the Pine Ridge Reservation, a very big Sioux reservation in South Dakota. And in the course of the Civil War that developed in the Pine Ridge Reservation, and there was, in a sense, kind of paramilitaries, kind of semi-official killing squads who went around murdering Indian people thought to be sympathetic to or members of the American Indian movement. The American Indian movement felt that its own leadership was sort of bought and paid for by the U.S. government, or collaborating with the U.S. government. So it's very controversial within within that society. Anime Aquash was murdered. John Graham was charged with that murder. And now, all these years later, Canada allowed John Graham to be extradited from Canada to face a trial in Rapid City, South Dakota, which will start in October. And this is...
That's an outrage. We'll be back to talk some more in a minute.
Thank you for listening to GCN. Be sure to visit GCNLive.com today.
Help, I need somebody. Help, not just anybody. Help, you know I need someone. Help. When I was younger, so much younger than today, I never needed anybody's help in any way. Now these days are gone, I'm not so self-assured. Gentlemen, open up the doors. Help me if you can, I'm feeling down. And I do appreciate you being around. Help me get my feet back on the ground. Won't you please help me?
Welcome back. This is the Dynamic Duo Show. I'm your host, Kevin Barrett. I'm on here every Monday and Friday. Co-host Jim Fetzer's on Tuesday through Thursday. And don't miss my shows on the Evil Rival Network, WTPRN.com, on the weekends from 3 to 5 p.m., 2 to 4 p.m. Central Time. Tomorrow I'll have on Splitting the Sky, a friend of my current guest, Professor Anthony Hall. Splitting the Sky is quite an eloquent, forceful, an uncompromising kind of guy. He's my kind of guy, in short, and if you haven't heard him before, you be sure you tune in there. That's, again, at We the People Radio Network, WTPRN.com. Tomorrow, shows from 2 to 4 p.m. Central Time. And, Tony, you were just talking about this outrage in which the Canadian government not only has, you know, famously extradited Leonard Peltier after the FBI blatantly lied and rigged up false evidence to get him sent down to the kangaroo courts of South Dakota, but then also did the same thing to John Graham, extradited from Vancouver to South Dakota. And as a U.S. American, I don't like this because, you know, I liked it better when Canada was the place where the draft resistors could go and be safe from extradition. Having people being extradited for kangaroo court proceedings in the U.S. from Canada kind of takes away a potential safe haven if things really melt down here.
Well, Harper, our prime minister, it's a minority government, so they can't just pass anything. I won't go into the details of it, but he comes from Alberta, and Alberta, as I say, is quite tied in. The main industry is oil and gas. It's kind of I look at Calgary as sort of a colony of Houston and Dallas. These kind of things are. Very, very, very frustrating, and it's a violation of our sovereign rights, our sovereign identity as Canadians. I'm trying to bring you along a little bit as you head north to Canada, and suggest some ways that we can talk about these issues that are specific to Canada, but, you know, they also have a lot to do with the United States and relations between Canada and the United States. But let me explain what John Graham, how it came to be that he is charged with killing Anime Aquash. Anime Aquash is a Mi'kmaq woman. I know her family in Nova Scotia. That's her home territory. So she got into South Dakota, was well connected with the leadership of the American Indian Movement. And the American Indian Movement was infiltrated, as was the Black Panthers, as was, you know, those were protesting Vietnam, those were standing up for civil rights. They were infiltrated by the FBI's COINTELPRO unit. And I'm sure, Kevin, you know about the COINTELPRO unit. But essentially, part of its mandate was to send in infiltrators, people who would be working for the police, present themselves as if they share the values of the American Indian Movement, but then try to get people arguing, destabilize them in different ways. If you can spread rumors, for instance, that might destroy a marriage. You know, really, really just try to destroy the lives and destabilize the lives of people who are trying to stand up for the rights of their people. Indigenous peoples in America have a very tough time, given the situations they're facing. So there was so much paranoia within the American Indian Movement, that, people were distrusting each other. So Anime Aquash was murdered. And we didn't know for many, we still don't know what were the circumstances, but there was the assumption that it was some kind of FBI thing. Her hands were literally cut off her body and sent to Washington to check her fingerprints. You know, can you imagine how humiliating that would be for the family? So the charge against John Graham and Arlo Looking Cloud, and there has been already a trial in South Dakota, is that he killed Anime Aquash. And we're talking about two Native people, both from Canada, Anime Aquash and John Graham, whose home territory is in Yukon, a federal territory of Canada. And to me, this demonstrates, you know, the ruthlessness historically of you know, trying to undermine dissent, trying to undermine those who have a different vision of what freedom, of what democracy, of what a good future would hold for their people than the dominant group, than the group that control the riches, the resources, the political economy of the United States. So the level of whether or not John Graham did it, I don't know. I wasn't there. But the reality is that AIM was destroyed as a forward movement of its people, and Splitting the Sky was very much involved and is very much involved in the American Indian Movement. And the Mohawks from Ontario and Quebec and New York are very important in that movement. So this is the context where 9/11, we can look at this and say, look, we have a history in Canada that the U.S. government doesn't square with us, is perfectly willing to lie, to even give legal authorities in Canada false evidence, as you know, Myrtle Pourbaix, her evidence was given to pull Leonard Peltier in 1975 back to the U.S. to face this kangaroo trial. He's in prison to this day. It subsequently came out that Myrtle Pourbaix, they threatened, the FBI threatened to take away her kids. It's really, really ugly politics. So when we look at 9/11, now I see in the Toronto Star here on the date is Friday, June 6th. The headline says 9/11 mastermind pleads for death. And it says here,
right?
Are you following this part?
That's a KSM.
Khalid Sheikh Muhammad, and it says here as the story by Michelle Shepard in the Toronto Star, the alleged mastermind of the 9/11 attacks asked to be sentenced to death so he could die as a martyr. So after being told Bin Laden, Bin Laden, Bin Laden, Bin Laden, oh, no, well, there's another guy called Saddam Hussein, and he's kind of the same ethnic group as bin Laden. So we should go to war against him because, you know, it's sort of this, it's obviously Arabs and
they all look alike.
and now we have these military commissions act, which all the world is looking at the United States and saying, you know, you're undermining the very basic principles that for hundreds of years people have fought for, the principle that you're innocent until proven guilty. You have to have a trial. The trial has to have live up to certain standards. But this Military Commissions Act has broken all that. So this Khalid Sheikh Mohammed now is being advertised that he is the mastermind of 9/11, and he has been tortured. He has been in these dark sites, and you know, it strikes me that he is kind of crazy.
They torture
9/11,
their minds are gone.
And I was responsible for the effort to hit Heathrow Airport and the Canary Wharf and Big Ben and
right.
Jimmy Carter and Bill Clinton, and you know, he wants to take credit, and this
right,
is
everything
what
he blew
US
up the Hindenburg
is showing us as the mastermind of 9/11.
Kidnap the Lindbergh baby. All right, we'll be back in a bit. This is Kevin Barrett. I'm talking with Professor Anthony Hall. He's going to be with me at this speaking engagement coming up real soon in Edmonton. So you can go to Edmonton911truth.com to find out more about that. We have one more segment. We'll be back in just a moment.
Cascadia Public Radio.
Duo show, Kevin Barrett, and today I'm talking with Anthony Hall. He's a globalization studies professor with whom I will be doing a speaking engagement in Edmonton on September 9th. And so to find out more about that, just go to Edmonton911truth.com.
Call me Tony, Kevin.
All right, Tony. Well, you're just listed on that site as Anthony. All the official stuff has you as Anthony, but I'll stick with Tony from now on.
Okay.
All right. So, yeah, you're talking about KSM, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, the guy who's confessed to, you know, every major attack and then someone is begging to be put to death. This really sounds like something out of the Stalinist show trials, doesn't it? And, you know, besides KSM, this guy, there's all sorts of anomalies in his checkered career. He was living high on the hog, partying. You know, he looks to be one of these high-living drinking, drug-using, playboy-type, so-called al-CIA, characters, while he was, you know, supposedly planning various terrorist acts that he's blamed for. And then when they supposedly arrested him in Pakistan, the Pakistani authorities, under control of the U.S. authorities, showed a room full of journalists alleged video footage of the alleged arrest of Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, and it was so blatantly bogus, such a pathetically obvious staged reenactment that the room full of journalists fell on the floor laughing. You can find that at the complete 9/11 timeline. Get these mainstream media reports on how ridiculous this arrest video was. And when the 9/11 Commission report put out their ridiculous myth, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed was their most quoted source, and yet at that point there was no evidence whatsoever that this guy was even in U.S. custody. The 9/11 Commission never saw one shred of actual evidence of any kind of interrogation that may have been done with him. They just took the word of whatever Bush administration CIA character helped Zelikow write the script. So the most quoted source of the 9/11 Commission is this guy that was arrested, or maybe not arrested, whatever, you know, a guy with a career that doesn't make any sense as a Muslim terrorist, no evidence whatsoever that he was even incarcerated or in custody at the time, no evidence of any interrogations or anything, and yet, footnote after footnote after footnote gives us KSM, 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 and now this poor guy, Torch until his mind is gone, is begging to be put to death and confessing to every atrocity of the past century. It's just beyond ridiculous that anybody
we saw kangaroo courts for Leonard Peltier, or we're going to see one for John Graham in South Dakota. The kangaroo court in Guantanamo Bay is absurd. And, Kevin, it is really sad. It's very troubling to see the United States in this dilemma where, you know, national institutions like their standard-setting institutions are coming up with these completely uncredible reports about the destruction of the World Trade Center 7, you know, patsy, trying to put it on this patsy called Khalid Sheikh Mohammed. You know, the United States was the guiding force. The administration of Franklin Roosevelt and the New Deal that led to the United Nations, that led to this idea that human beings, we need to be governed by law, we need due process, we need to respect universal human rights, and the United Nations became a venue in New York for such important if it wasn't actually applied, at least the idea that we can do better as human beings, that we can aspire to a world of decency, a world governed by laws and the self-determination of peoples rather than by guns and by force. The United States, you know, there's this dual personality in the United States, and it's so sad to see, you know, our neighbor, our friends, our own, in a sense, our own people. I mean, obviously, you and I don't talk that much differently. We have similar experiences in life. To see the United States fall this low, based on the lies of 9/11, based on this phony, fraudulent war on terror, whose real purpose is to back up oligarchs and entrench interests everywhere, and to plant suspicions. And if you question the system, well, maybe you're a criminal. Maybe there's a terrorist plot in the background. I mean, this has been so devastating. This is the most serious, comprehensive effort of psychological warfare in the history of the world, really. But there are voices like yourself. There are people willing to make a stand, and in Canada, we look to the better part of the United States. We look to the heroic traditions of those who fought for, you know, collective bargaining, for women's rights. Surely now, we need to pull together, and we need to cut through this monstrosity of the lies of 9/11 to, in which all of these devastating things, these invasions of other countries, these undermining of civil liberties, you know, Naomi Wolf's recent text talking about, there's a pattern here. It's the same pattern that we've seen in other drifts to fascism. This
must
can't
go on.
Be allowed to happen.
Agreed, completely. And we need some help from people outside the borders of the USA, where the psychological impediments to facing the truth about these matters may not be quite as strong as they are in some quarters down here. Hey, Mike from Kentucky, I guess you're still there. How's it going?
Oh, pretty good. I just want to thank you both for all you're doing. We are in a heck of a lot of trouble. I'm with you on the rule of law and universal human rights. I'm going to ring off and get back to my deck. But I did want to make one little correction. You guys were saying before that the sun is the center of the universe. Actually, the sun is the center of the solar system.
Yeah.
Center.
I'm talking in the context of how it was seen in the days.
That was the heliocentric.
Galileo and.
Right. Well, the center of the universe is actually Cynthia McKinney.
There you go. Thank you.
Okay, keep up the good work. All right.
Take care.
Bye bye.
Yeah. Bye. Well, yeah, hey, I'm running as a Libertarian for Congress at BarrettForCongress.us, but I'm going to be voting for Cynthia McKinney.
Can you explain this Ron Paul thing and Libertarian? Like,
sure.
I, Can you just say it in a phrase or two, what's going on?
The reason I admire Ron Paul so much is that he is the ultimate peace candidate. He wants to end the empire. He wants to shut down the Federal Reserve, which is the banker's monopoly behind the empire. And then he wants to shut down every U.S. military base, all 700-plus in all 130 countries, bring all the troops home, and cut back that military budget to just defending the borders. And to me, that's the most radical anti-empire platform out there. And that's one reason Ron Paul is a hero of mine.
Yeah. Libertarian, though. What about the idea that, don't these companies that have been saying, you know, leave us alone, we're just doing business, government shouldn't interfere with this. Isn't it time that these companies have to be a little bit accountable?
Well, I agree completely, Tony. In fact, I think, you know, I'm for more antitrust enforcement. My libertarian philosophy is that for a genuine free market, the government has to be a fair referee, and we need to bust up all of these kinds of oligarchical monopolies and cartels, which are actually governments.
Like
those are like secret governments. They're bigger and more powerful than the government, you know, the official government.
Oh, yeah, the official government that we vote for. They're just storefront. You know,
exactly.
Behind it is these corporations. Hey, you're sounding a lot like Teddy Roosevelt at his peak.
I think I quoted from him on my webpage. And, you know, some of the classical libertarians are taking me to task for this. But I'm a new libertarian. I've told them that, and I think the libertarians need to rethink some of their economic positions.
But then don't forget, he did pull a lot of support that would have gone to Eugene Debs and the socialists. And, you know, the first Red Scare, when they started to, you know, to profile people and call them enemy aliens and export them, you know, that goes back to 1919. And Eugene Debs, there was once a powerful socialist movement in the United States, and it was undermined.
Well, don't get me praising socialism, or the libertarians are going to really come after me. I already have enough trouble with some of that stuff.
Yeah, well, fabulous to the excitement around this 9/11 movement, the way that people from all parts of the political spectrum are talking. We're actually relating about a new vision, and we're getting beyond these old categories, and it's a new kind of politics. When I surf internet and I see, you know, all these young people taking a stand, getting involved in their communities, trying to inform, you know, believing that the system works.
You know, I love it too. It's going to be great to meet you in person, and people can find out about that event at EdmontonNineElevenTruth.com. Take care, Tony. It's been a great conversation as always.
See you in a few days, man. I can hardly wait.
All right. Bye bye. Anthony Hall. Kevin Barrett from BarrettForCongress.us signing off.